Mary Beard is a world-renowned classicist and academic, a professor of classics at Cambridge University, and a popular blogger and television personality in England. Her latest book, Confronting the Classics, is a collection of essays and book reviews about topics in the ancient world, ranging from Nero and Cleopatra to the Roman baker who had the nerve to create a monument to himself and his craft in the center of the city. The book is published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Beard to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
What do you mean by confronting the classics? What are the experts fighting about?
I think I mean really, look, we tend to think of the classics as being sort of something, you know, out there, something a bit passive, something that's probably quite good for you, but not something that you get up front close to and grapple with. So it's about wrestling with, arguing with, talking with the ancients. It's about being active.
Well, most people don't even think much about the classics, although they have seen movies like Gladiator and the HBO series Rome and shows like that. That's their sense of the ancient world.
Well, I think they don't think much about the classics, but and they always say, "Oh, I don't know anything about Greece and Rome. I don't know anything." And then you say, "Well, did you see Gladiator? You know, did you watch Rome?" And I think it's one of those kind of myths that people have, that there's kind of boffins like me somewhere who really know about it. And then there's people, then the rest of the world, and they're hopelessly ignorant. They know huge amounts about the classics. They can read Roman numbers, you know. they watch the telly.
But they no longer have Latin available to them in most schools.
I think what is sad, and I think this is true on both sides of the Atlantic, is that relatively few people get a chance, certainly at high school. Quite a lot do when they get to college, but at high school they get relatively little chance to learn Latin. But on the other hand, people are reading translations of ancient authors with huge relish. You know, they're going to see revivals of Greek tragedy. You know, they know about Socrates, you know. And I think, you know, one of the things that my book is trying to do, I think, is to say, look, you know, this isn't scary. And there are some things you kind of need to know, but this isn't a subject which is trying to keep you out. It's trying to welcome you in, actually.
Although I do remember that when I was a kid, almost everybody I knew was obsessed by Greek mythology. We knew all the stories. Less likely today.
I don't know. There's cartoon strips and all kinds of references in comics and movies. And, you know, look, you know, people, I thought that 300 and Troy, I actually thought they were pretty ghastly as movies. But they certainly looked at Greek mythology up front.
Wasn't there recently an international petition launched to ask UNESCO to declare Latin and Greek as specially protected intangible heritage of humanity? So there, despite what you're saying, there are a lot of people who think the classics are in danger.
I think that's true. And I think at one stage they were going to give the petition to the president of Italy, which I think he probably had rather more in his hands.
That was Berlusconi at the time.
Yes, I think it was. I think that was not a great move. But I think what you've got to realise is that classics is a subject that's kind of always thought that it was going down the tubes. Now, if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, you find, you know, all my, you know, what would have then been my colleagues in Oxford and Cambridge getting around saying this subject isn't going to survive. You know, we've got, you know, people always used to know classics better than we do. And I think there's something, one of the things in a funny way which keeps that subject going is the sense that we've got to keep up with the past. If we don't really get in there, it might disappear.
But it was also seen as the province of the elite. And people like Ezra Pound, who would throw in a little bit of a Greek into their poems, I guess to show off just how much they knew.
There is a bit of a show-off. There is a bit of a kind of upper-class, toff show-off element to it. And I think I have to say that we probably suffer much more from that in the UK than you do here. And, you know, one of the biggest jobs I do when I'm going around to talk to high school kids, you know, is to try and demythologise that, to say, look, this isn't just a subject for the rich. Actually, what's been great about the United States is that classics, and particularly Rome, has been rooted in the way the states have thought about themselves as a country from the founding fathers.
Well, do they get interpreted differently depending on where you are? Goebbels was a lover of the classics. I think he had Homer on his bedstead.
Yes. I mean, I think one thing you've got to realize is that fascinating and interesting as the stuff is, it doesn't necessarily make you a good person. And you know, some of the world's nastiest tyrants have been very keen on Homer, but some of the world's biggest revolutionaries. You know, what did Karl Marx do his dissertation, his doctoral dissertation in Greek philosophy?
There are people who claim that studying Latin increases IQ scores. It also helps you learn French and Italian and Spanish. Are those good enough reasons to study these dead languages?
There are people who claim that. They're always very much disputed. And I'm sure that they're kind of side benefits to learning Latin and Greek. But frankly, I always think, look, if I wanted to learn French, if my real aim was to learn French, I wouldn't go and learn Latin first, so that I could learn French more easily. I think what you have to say is there is one reason to learn Latin, which caps everything else, which is that wonderful things are written in it. And it's worth reading them in the original.
My guest is Mary Beard, whose latest book is a collection of essays confronting the classics, traditions, adventures, and innovations. Well, we keep on getting new translations. For example, it seems to me every year we get another Iliad and another Odyssey, and I wonder why haven't the other translations already done the job?
I mean, I think the interesting answer to that is no. And if you want to really test that out, go back and look at the translations of, say, Greek tragedy, Euripides, that were done by really extremely learned people in the beginning of the 20th century, Gilbert Murray, for example. And you see that they have translated the Greek text into something which is somehow almost equally foreign to us. And the point about translation is that it's not a kind of static medium. When you translate something, what you're doing is making it make sense to you. And so our translations of Euripides see different things in Euripides, and they put it into an idiom which is very different.
Because Euripides seems to be speaking to the modern experience, so why not write it accordingly? Medea is something we all would understand.
You know, exactly. I mean, Euripides has fantastic tragic heroines, and people translating him in the late 19th century, I mean, basically they thought women should be in their place in the kitchen. They thought that Medea had nothing to be said for her whatsoever and translated accordingly.
You talk about the difficulty of translating Thucydides because of the way he wrote and because of what he was attempting to do with history.
Yeah, I mean, I think Thucydides is an absolutely fantastic case because every international relations course, and you know, most modern politicians usually have a bit of a quip from Thucydides, you know, kind of power-related quip up their sleeve. If you go back and look at the Greek text, what you discover is that Thucydides is next to untranslatable. He's trying to do the revolutionary, really revolutionary thing in the 5th century BC of write an analytical history, trying to write a history that doesn't demand seeing divine intervention everywhere. He's trying to struggle with ideas of power. And the result is extremely smart, extremely clever, and extremely difficult, and close to untranslatable. And better classicists than I have struggled to translate Thucydides for centuries now.
I don't want to go into this, but you had issues with Donald Kagan's book, Thucydides, The Reinvention of History.
I had issues with Kagan. Kagan is an absolutely fantastically venerable and hugely productive scholar. And in some ways, I'm going to sound terrible, it was a slightly elderly book. He was looking at Thucydides very much still as he looked at it 20, 30, 40 years ago.
There are myths that have arisen around figures like Alexander the Great, Cleopatra, that's made it impossible for us to ever get an accurate historical picture of them.
Yeah. I mean, if anybody said, can we know what the real Alexander the Great was like? You have to say, no, we can't. But you also have to say, you mustn't let that be a downer, you know, because you could say, oh, help, you know, what don't we get, we're going to give up then. But actually,
but what's the problem there? Because he was written about a lot during his lifetime. Was it all just hagiography, or or he's the villain of the story?
Alexander was written about a lot during his lifetime, and all of that writing has disappeared. And what we have is actually a Roman version of it. We have Roman age writers 300, 400 years later trying to reconstruct that story and giving a very interesting but essentially Roman spin. It would be like me trying to give a spin on Henry VIII. And in fact, now I think one of the things that's very funny is that even the name Alexander the Great, the first reference we have to that is in, it's actually in a Roman comic play of the 2nd century BC. It's not something which comes directly from Alexander. And that makes the tradition, I think, more interesting and more complicated.
So should we assume that he wasn't as great as he's come down to us to being?
I don't know what we should assume. I think there's a rather blokish element to our admiration of him. You know, people say he was a great conqueror. And I tend to say, well, if you put the word massacrer instead of conqueror, does that make the word great sound a bit different? You know, the great massacres of Alexander the Great, a bit different from victories.
You write a lot about the senses of humor that various Roman emperors had. Sometimes appreciated, sometimes not appreciated. But in trying to understand these figures, is it important to have a grasp of what they thought was funny?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential. I mean, we have a terribly sort of staid view of the Romans. We think that they kind of built bridges and didn't giggle. Actually, one of the most important aspects of Roman culture was laughter, whether right or wrong, silly jokes. I mean, the Emperor Elagabalus, who actually goes down in history as a rather bad emperor, in fact, he appears to have been the inventor of the practical joke we'd call the whoopee cushion. He invites people to dinner, puts them on inflatable cushions, and then laughs like a drain when they let the air out of the cushions and the poor old guests end up on the floor. Now, I'm not quite sure what that tells you about Roman power, but I think it's important to have it in there.
Well, we also get the story of Nero and the horse, and understanding it in terms of humor, Nero doesn't come across as evil as we often think of him.
And Caligula. It's the Caligula.
Oh, it was Caligula?
Yes,
yeah.
But, you know, they're hardly different.
Nero, we have the violin, playing the fiddle.
Yes,
of
he does the violin.
There was no violin.
Yeah, okay. No. Caligula's supposed to have made his horse a consul, and this is hugely criticised by every writer afterwards, you know, saying, how could you be so insulting as to just turn your pet into a consul? I always think that probably what Caligula said one evening, you know, as all the elite were round at dinner, you know, God, you're a hopeless shower, aren't you? I might as well make my horse a consul as you. And that what goes down in history as Caligula was going to make his horse a consul.
Now, we don't have much time, and you cover a lot of topics here, but one that I just want to address a bit is the whole matter of art theft. I'm assuming from what I've read here that you think the Elgin Marbles should remain in the British Museum.
I have a very, very careful position on the Elgin Marbles, just that I think that both the arguments for sending them back and the arguments for keeping them in England, both of them are rather bad, actually.
But you also point out that art theft has been going on since the very beginnings of time.
I think
the Romans were stealing the Greek treasures.
Really, I think the problem is that there isn't a simple answer to this. You know, the Romans stole the treasures from the Greeks. The British and the French took works of art back home. Sometimes it was theft, sometimes it was rescue. And I think that you have to be very careful about trying to unwrite those kind of crimes from the past. And now this is completely different from problems of, you know, Jewish art treasures in the Second World War. That's very recent. I'm not sure that you can any more make an easy case for sending the Elgin Marbles back to Greece as you can send the stuff that the Emperor Augustus took from Greece back there. It's very, very hard.
And you'd be emptying out half of Berlin's museums if you sent the stuff back. Mary Beard is a professor of classics at Cambridge University, author of the best-selling The Fires of Vesuvius. Probably have read her in the New York Review of Books, her latest book, Confronting the Classics, Traditions, Adventures, and Innovations. It's published by Live Right. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.